Okay, last week we covered the introduction to Daniel, which was how Daniel got to be in Babylon. We said at that time he's probably a young man, somewhere between probably 15, 17 years old, something like that, wound up being selected by some process to be carried off from his homeland, to go down into off into the land of Babylon, there to be trained. He was going to be enrolled in the University of Babylon. Three-year program where they were going to teach them literature and writing and language and all kinds of things, and including science, which, okay, there's a mixture of some astrology there, but there was some real science there that was going on as well, as they were very famous, the Babylonians were, for their observations of the stars and of the seasons and of the records that they kept. So as we begin in the second chapter, Daniel and his friends have been at the school for probably a year now, because it starts out and it says that it's in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. And the conquering of Jerusalem, the carrying off of the first captives, was during the first year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. He had just really taken over from his dad when they started that. So they're only a year and a part maybe into this three-year program, when Nebuchadnezzar has a troubling dream, and that's what chapter 2 is all about here. So let's take a look at the first part of the chapter. It says that in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. And then the king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came in, and they stood before the king. And the king said to them, "I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream." And the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation." And the king replied to the Chaldeans, "The command from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made into a rubbish heap. But if you declare the dream and its interpretation, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. And therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation." And they answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will declare the interpretation." But the king replied, "I know for certain that you are bargaining for time, inasmuch as you have seen that the command from me is firm. Then if you do not make known this dream to me, there is only one decree for you, for you have agreed together to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the situation is changed. And therefore, tell me the dream, that I may know that you can declare to me its interpretation." So that's the sort of confrontation that's set up there. We've got this this problem. Now, when it lists all of those folks that he's calling in, there's various interpretations and translations of that, depending on what version you have, as to whether it calls them magicians or wise men or conjurers and all of that kind of thing. These were simply his advisors, the wisest people he knew. These were the ones who were probably some of Daniel's teachers, okay? They're sort of the heads of the university there. And if anybody knows anything about stars and signs, and they're teaching this stuff, right? So surely these are the ones who should know. And so the king is simple. He goes, "Well, you know, I'm paying all you guys for all of this, right? I mean, they're on the king's salary. I got a problem. I had this dream. It's bugging me really badly. So just tell me the dream, and then tell me what it's all about." What'd they want to do? Yeah, it's sort of like if you go to a fortune teller today and ask them the same thing, what are they going to want to know? Yeah, just tell me the dream, right? And he goes, no, that's too easy. If I tell you the dream, you're all going to conspire and you're all going to lie. Now, one of the things to notice here, it says, "And they came in a second time." There's some passage of time here. I'm sure that these men kind of stood around in their robes and, you know, thought for a while and said, "We'll get back to you." Right? They had no idea how to answer this to begin with. So they're going to go off and they're going to conspire together and say, "You know, what are we going to do?" And so they're going to come back into the kingdom and go, "You know, we've made some progress, but we need some hints." And he's going to say, "You're stalling." That's what they were doing, right? They're just stalling for time, trying to get something that maybe he'd give in. He's anxious. He's troubled. Get a hint from somewhere. You know, I wouldn't put it past them if they're out, you know, talking to the guards or anybody else, right? They're going, did you hear him talk anything about this? You know, come on, come on, give us a clue. Or how about you? You serve him his meal every day. Maybe you could go to stand on the side and see if he accidentally talks about it or something. They're going to go to any length that they can, but they're not having any success. And so moreover, the thing which the king demands is difficult, and there is no one else who would declare it to the king except gods, whose dwelling place is not with mortal flesh. So that's their final thing, as they're saying, you know, you're asking us the impossible. But remember, he's king, right? He's Nebuchadnezzar. Impossible is not in his vocabulary. I'm the king. I declare it, it shall be done. And if it's not, he says, because of the king became indignant and very furious and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain. And they look for Daniel and his friends to kill them. What's he doing? Cleaning house. If you guys aren't up to this job, then we'll start over. We'll kill all of these, and then I'll find some others who can take on this job. Because clearly, you've just demonstrated that you're not proficient at what I'm paying you for. That's the idea. The problem is this is going to rub off on all the students as well. It says they're going to look for Daniel and his friends. You think Nebuchadnezzar or any of these wise men had thought to go ask any of the kids in the university if they could help? That's not where you go for help, right? Daniel then probably knew something was up. They don't know what's going on. Look here. Daniel replies with discretion and discernment to Arioch, the captain of the king's bodyguard, who had gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. Now, think about this. This is a guy who likes these kids, right? He's been put in charge of them. He's the king's bodyguard, and he's been given a command to go out and kill a bunch of his friends, is really what it boils down to. So he's probably not real anxious to go out and just do this summarily and real fast. And so when Daniel comes up and approaches him, he approaches him with discernment and discretion, and he says to Arioch, the king's commander, for what reason is the decree from the king so urgent? And then Arioch informed him about the matter. They didn't even know about it. So Daniel went in and requested of the king that he would give him time in order that he might declare the interpretation to the king. That's an interesting little statement there. You don't read much out of it, but think about it. You remember when Esther was in the court of the Persians, and she was wanting to go talk to the king? That was a little bit troublesome for her, right? Why? You don't just go waltzing into the throne room and go, oh, hey, buddy, king, you know, I need to talk to you for a minute. No, that's not how it went. You didn't get there unless the king summoned you, or unless you had something really important. You went through the right channels, and you got all the right things lined up to go in there. But what does it say here? It does. And Daniel went in and talked to the king. Somehow, he got an audience, talked to the king, and said, king, can you give us just a little more time? Now, you know, I'm going to just kind of throw this in there. I think Daniel was probably a pretty good-looking kid, and he was very polite, and it says he showed a lot of discernment. And I think he just kind of won the king over a little bit here. And it's like, ah, that's one of the guys I'm going to have killed. Yeah, all right, you know, I'll give you an extra week. What's an extra week here, you know? You have a few days. So Daniel has bought some time. He's gone in before the monarch that could have slain him just by walking into the room, gotten a little extra time. And where does Daniel go then? He goes to his friends, and he says, we're in trouble, boys. We got to figure a way out of this. So Daniel went to his house and informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, about the matter, and so they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. This was one of those things where it's a sink or swim thing, right? There's no way they can distance themselves. They're just in that pot, whether they're the same or not. You know, whether they would like to be known as, you know, Hebrews, and with these differences, in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes, they're all in the same group together, and they're going to be killed. So how do they react to it? What are they going to do? They're going to pray. Okay? You take your case before God. And they knew enough to do that. And so they pray, and guess what happens? Then Daniel, the mystery was revealed in a night vision. And Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Verses 20 to 23. I'm sure he thought about this. This probably wasn't just spontaneous, but this is what Daniel wrote down in his own book, about how he felt when he got that revelation and how elated he was. Daniel said, "Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the time and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and power. Even now you have made known to me what we have requested of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." I want to think about that for just a second, though, because remember, he's a young man. Right? He's maybe got a year under his belt or so here with all of these Babylonians all around. And so far, he's hanging in there. He's not been corrupted by what's going on. And now he's got this opportunity that it's life or death for him and his friends. And he prays, and God reveals this to him. Now, there's several ways he could take and react with that, right? Can you imagine? A lot of 16, 17-year-old kids that I know coming up with this kind of thing would go like, "Yeah, we're in, you know. I got it. I can handle this. We'll make a show here, you know. Show how smart I am." What's Daniel's attitude? Absolutely gives God the credit. Right here in the beginning, when no one else is around even, he's giving God the credit. Notice what he understands about that. He says, "You've given me two things. You've given me wisdom and what else? Might, power." What he's fixing to do is going to change the relationship that he's going to have with the Babylonians for the rest of his life. This is the first time that God has come to him. This is the first time that he's essentially been the recipient of what you might think of as direct revelation from his God. In this time of trouble, in this place where he thought he had no friends other than just those few that came with him, his faith now has held him to a point where he can say, "God is with me." And so he has to capitalize on that, but he has to do so with humility, and you see that all throughout Daniel. This is just the first of what molds him as he grows into a man. And so he's got this knowledge, it's come to him, and now he's got to go before the king. So he goes to the bodyguard again, he goes into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and spoke to him as follows, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me into the king's presence, and I will declare the interpretation to the king." Now, that's a pretty strong statement there as well. He's going to be taken into the king's presence. Life is on the line. But Arioch hurriedly brought Daniel into the king's presence and spoke to him as follows, "I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can make the interpretation known to the king." I don't know if he's really taking credit here or not. He said, "I found him." And the king said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, "Are you able to make this known to me, the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?" Daniel answered before the king and said, "As for the mystery about which the king has inquired, neither wise men or conjurers or magicians or diviners are able to declare it to the king." Let's just stop there for a second. Can you imagine he's standing there and the king says, "Can you do this?" And Daniel opens with, "It can't be done." You know how much the king was this close to exploding before Daniel went on there, right? It's like wise men, conjurers, all these people you've been relying on, they can't do it. But notice how he follows up. "However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mystery, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the latter days. This was your dream and the visions in your mind while you were on your bed. As for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turned to what would take place in the future. And he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what will take place. But as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing in me any more than in any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind." That's an interesting interplay there, because when he's saying, he doesn't even start out by saying, "God made this made known to me." He's saying, "God revealed something to you." He wants Nebuchadnezzar to understand how important this is, and that it was Nebuchadnezzar who got the first revelation from God, right? Because this dream came from God to Nebuchadnezzar as the king. Nebuchadnezzar is just a really interesting person as you start studying through here. You ever thought about when we do hopefully make it to heaven, who will meet there and who won't be there that we'll be surprised at? And you know, it's not going to surprise me a whole lot if maybe Nebuchadnezzar is one of those who winds up there as you go on and see what his interactions. Because at some point, there are a lot of times when he comes up saying, there is no other God but Jehovah God. Now, I don't know if that was strong enough to carry him over the line to finally get rid of all of his idolatry before he died. But he's getting a delivery of a message and an interaction with Jehovah God that very few people on this earth did. And this is the first one. Daniel's pointing it out to him. You understand, King, that you have received revelation. As for me, I'm nothing. He just gave me an interpretation because you needed to know it. So Daniel puts himself in that place. Now let's take a look at this dream. Most of us are familiar with it. One other thing, 28, verse 28. We're going to see this phrase, latter days, multiple times in the book of Daniel. And I'm going to point it out each time we hit to it. And I want you to understand that that phrase can be interpreted different ways. What does it mean when you say latter days? There are some people who want to say, well, that's like the end judgment, the last judgment. Latter day, that's the end judgment. Let's just look at the literal words. Latter days, what does that mean? Yeah, it's the end of something. It's just the end of something. That's really all it is. And we're going to find out that there were multiple ends that Daniel's going to talk about. There are ends of empires. There's the end of the Jewish world as they knew it. And there is an end time. But latter days, you can't always just look at it and know exactly what it is. You've got to look at the context and see what's going to happen. So Daniel's going to be talking in the context of a latter days here. And he's going to have several of them that goes in the book. So kind of keep an eye out for those. But he starts in with a dream, and here's the dream. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. And that statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. And the head of that statue was made of fine gold. Its breast and its arms are of silver, and its belly and its thighs of bronze, and its legs of iron. And its feet, partly of iron, partly of clay. And you continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. And then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now that's the dream. You got to get that in your picture because, you know, there's this huge statue. And it's pretty awesome to look at. And it's valuable. I mean, those metals all the way down even to the iron were valuable. Obviously the gold's a little on the, you know, most desired side. And you got some silver, you got some bronze, you got some iron down there. And then when the stone gets cut out of this mountain, and you can see him watching this thing, and the stone whaps the feet. And when it does that, the whole thing just starts crumbling and falling over. And as that collapses, it just disintegrates into motes of dust. You see, that's like, we don't get out and winnow wheat these days, you know, so it's a little hard to imagine. But everybody's seen dust devils and dust storms around here in this part of the world, right? Okay, so that's what he's talking about. Is just the air is filled with this fine stuff, and it just kind of blows away. So here was this immense statue, and what's happened to it? It's gone. It's gone. Now, what's in its place? The stone that crushed it. It starts growing up. And it grows into what? A mountain. Okay? So, all of those, highly symbolic, obviously. And so, when you look at that, he says, now, that was a dream. Now, at this point, what do you think Nebuchadnezzar's thinking? He got it. This guy's going to... He told me the dream. I haven't told a soul. And he's got it down pat, all the way to every description of it. And then Daniel says, and here's the interpretation. So now he's going to be on edge, waiting for that to come across. This was the dream, and now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the king of kings. to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory, and wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them. You are the head of gold. That's pretty good. How do we start out there? On top, literally, right? He's at the top there. So there's a couple of things, obviously, that's going to get the favor of Nebuchadnezzar as he's looking at it. But it also sets the stage for what's coming. Because as Nebuchadnezzar is building this empire, and you got to remember, he's in the stages of building things up. Why would he be thinking about the future anyway? What's one of the goals when kings get up and try to build these empires like that? Okay, succession. You know, we got to be remembered. We got to pass it on to the right folks, and they'll build it up. And there's always these dreams for the future and the dynasty that you're going to establish. And I'm sure that's part of what he's thinking about is, you know, I don't know what his kids are like, but, you know, how are they going to do the right thing? Are they going to take this over? What's going to happen to this empire that I'm building and all the blood, sweat, and tears I'm putting into it? And here's Daniel saying, and you are the head of gold, and God has given you all of this power and authority. But then he says, after you there will rise another kingdom, inferior to you, and then a third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. So he's making two more kingdoms there, and he specifically says that next one is inferior. What's the implication about the next one? Yeah. See, we're going from gold to silver to bronze, so we're kind of coming down the scale here a little bit. But then he concentrates on this fourth one. He says, there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch iron crushes and shatters all things. So, like iron that breaks into pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with the clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, even as the iron does not combine with pottery. Four kingdoms there that he's mentioned. Each one with different characteristics as he goes down. But that's not the end of the story. He says, in the days of those kings, which kings? That fourth empire, right? He's letting it known. You got the four going down. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. So there's the dream, and there's its interpretation. Now, we look back in history and think back about what all went on there. You think Nebuchadnezzar has any idea who these other kingdoms are likely to be? No. Who's the only great kingdom around here right now? It's Babylon. Assyria was the one just before him. How's Assyria doing lately? Battle of Carchemish, just a year or two before, he crushed them, okay? The Assyrians are gone, effectively. Who's next? Who's going to be the next big empire after Babylon? Medes and Persians, okay? Now, in one way, that's kind of interesting. At least he's been told they're inferior, but what's that kind of mean? That means that what's going to happen to Babylon? It's going to be gone too, right? So this is one of those good news, bad news kind of things. He's the head of gold, and God has given him an awful lot. But the bad news is his kingdom's not going to last. Something else is going to come in. And the Medes and Persians were next. How about the third kingdom? Which one was that? We talked about it this morning. Yeah, Alexander the Great, the Greeks that came in, conquered the world. How about that fourth kingdom? Where are we up to at this point? Rome, yeah. And if you look at history in that area of the world, you know, there were some lulls, there were some things that kind of came and went, and some little folks in between, but there were really only four empires. If you start with Babylon and you look at history, there's only one way to line this stuff up, folks. That's just the way it fits in history. And in fact, as we're going to see later, the Greeks are actually mentioned in Daniel specifically. I think it was one of those that the high priest there at Jerusalem probably went and talked to Alexander and said, wait, you know, don't kill us. It's been prophesied that you're going to be here. Look, let me show you. And won the safety of Jerusalem at that time from Daniel, from the prophecies that were given there. So we've got this dream. We've got four kingdoms. But it doesn't just end at it, well, you know, we have four kingdoms and the fourth one, you know, it's big and it's got some devices, some problems, and it falls apart. What's the real thing about this prophecy that's important to the future? Do all the kingdoms just fall away and they're all dead? Yeah. Nebuchadnezzar may have wanted a permanent kingdom, but God's telling him you're not going to get one. But down the line, there's coming one. And there is a permanent kingdom that's coming. One that when it's set up, it will never be destroyed. You see, that's the one that everybody kind of is trying to figure out, what is that one? You know, what is that kingdom? And Daniel's going to have a lot more to say on it. So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it now, but I think everybody kind of understands that this is one of the prophecies of the establishment of God's kingdom here on this earth that was different than the selecting of the Jewish nation to be his people. Right? He's not talking about the Jewish nation here. They've already been destroyed effectively. And they're going to get a little chance to come back, but it's never going to be back the same. And he's already said in Jeremiah that the Jeconiah would have no one to sit on the throne of David after him. And so we've got an end of the line there as far as it looks to them on the kings. So who can it be? Well, he doesn't say here, right? This dream says it's going to happen. It gives us this imagery that tells us how inevitable it's going to be, how powerful it's going to be, but that it will come. Daniel 2 is interesting at that. Let's go ahead and finish it up there, and then we're going to show how all this fits in a couple of other places. So King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel and gave orders to present him an offering and fragrant incense. And the king answered Daniel and said, surely your God is a God of God and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. And then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel made request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon, while Daniel was at the king's court. So, how did it turn out for Daniel and his friends this time? Not too bad. Now, we don't know that it was an immediate promotion at this point. He may have sent him back and had him finish school, but clearly he's got his eye on him. Clearly they're moving up in the rank. He now trusts Daniel, and Daniel is now going to be a part of his court. Talk about God putting people at the right place for the time that it's needed. You know, we see that real clearly in Esther, but sometimes we don't think about that in the terms of what Daniel is going to provide in Babylon. What's his position now? What's his position going to be? Right-hand man, but it also says that he's made him chief of what? Chief of the wise men. Remember who he said those were? Those were the scientists, the professors, the astrologers, all of those people who were collecting all of this stuff. They were the ones responsible for safekeeping knowledge in Babylon. And now who's in charge but Daniel? And when the country that Daniel came from is destroyed and Jerusalem is in tatters and they're hardly able to make ends meet, and the priesthood is gone, and worship is in shambles, and the knowledge of God is fading, where is it going to be maintained? But in Babylon, under Daniel. And in fact, when they come back out of captivity, they're able to bring back some things that were preserved all through this time period. And I'm sure Daniel had a hand in that. You know, when you start looking at the position that he was given and the faith that he had, and part of what his duty was to preserve those things through this exile so that when the time was up, they had what they needed to go back. So, you think they had writings of the law back then? Yeah. Daniel's in charge of that. He's got a big library. Libraries love to acquire things. Send some guys back to Jerusalem. Let's find those scrolls. Get them in here. If you can't find enough, we'll make copies of them, right? He's got an army of people that can copy for him now. We'll preserve the knowledge. So that tells us a little bit, not only of how Daniel got to Babylon, but the beginnings of how he became so influential in Babylon. Kind of reminds you of somebody else in a way. Joseph in Egypt, right? Esther in the Persian court. Just over and over, as you look at the history, God provided the right person in the right place to take care of his needs or the needs of his people. And Daniel's one of those. Now let's talk just for a minute about Daniel 2 in this dream. When we're looking at people and trying to figure out what this kingdom is, this is a great place to start because it basically gives us that knowledge that a kingdom is going to be set up. But there's a couple of chapters. You just remember the twos and you'll be in pretty good shape. Go back to Isaiah, the second chapter. Isaiah 2 is another one that talks about some of the things that are going to happen in the latter days, the future time. And in Isaiah 2, he talks about another interesting thing, a mountain. And everyone there is flowing to the mountain. All nations are flowing to this mountain. And it's another prophecy of how people are going to get together in a very different way than they were under the Jewish reign, where everybody had to be a Jew, right? Because he's talking about these many nations flowing into it. So we've got all these many nations in Isaiah 2. We've got this permanent kingdom in Daniel 2. What's another chapter 2 we need to go to here? Joel 2, okay? In the last days, what's going to happen? I will pour forth my spirit upon all men. So we've got all this prophecy of the mountain and everybody gathering to it, of the kingdom that's going to be established, of God pouring out his spirit upon people. Where does it all come together? Acts 2. You just take Isaiah 2, Daniel 2, Joel 2, and Acts 2, and you've got a great way to show people the coming of the kingdom. And it all kind of fits together. That's where it's supposed to fit. He's just giving us that view. But sometimes it's kind of fun if you put yourself back into their side to look at from Nebuchadnezzar's viewpoint. That's not what he understood. But he knew something special had happened, didn't he? Because this is something no man could have done. Tell me the dream. I'll tell you the interpretation. And he did it. So, the ascendancy of Daniel has begun. They are making their way in a strange land, doing pretty well, but there's always bumps along the road too. It's never perfect sailing. And Daniel's going to have his own set of trials and he and his friends to overcome. And that kind of puts us into the third chapter. We don't know exactly when this came, but the third chapter is another statue that we're going to have to talk about. So before we start that, any questions, comments on Daniel 2? Long chapter with me. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Kathy was just saying that, you know, a lot of the people that God picks are humble. And kind of is a problem if you start losing that. He's a good example of that, too. Who's our classic example of losing their humility? Saul, right? King Saul. Remember when they first selected him king? Where was he? He was out hiding in the baggage carts. He didn't want all the fame and fortune and stuff. But by the time we get to offering the sacrifices, you know, he's big stuff and out front and kind of lost all of that. And loses the kingdom as a result. So Daniel definitely was a humble man. Anything else? Yes.
And
Well, not necessarily. Aramaic, okay, she was asking about the, and in fact, the book itself, if you look at it in my notes that I handed you there, Daniel is in Hebrew up until that very point in the book, and then it switches to Aramaic. And then for the next couple chapters, they're in Aramaic, and then it switches back to Hebrew, I think in the seventh chapter. Anyway, I have to look it up, but whatever the notes say. I wrote it down there, and I don't remember. Aramaic was almost like a polyglot kind of language at the time. It was the common speech. It wasn't Chaldean. It was distinct from Chaldean. And so it would have been the language that everyone would have been able to understand, kind of the lingua franca of their day, which in this day is English, and lingua franca is what? It's Latin. And so we use a Latin phrase to talk about a common English language. Go figure, right? That's the way languages work in this world. So Aramaic was just the common language there. And so that's why I take it as Daniel probably spoke Hebrew and some Aramaic having grown up in Jerusalem area, but he didn't speak Chaldean. Okay? And the king is going to speak Chaldean and probably Aramaic. And so the common language between them is going to be Aramaic. And that's what he's going to talk in. Does that make sense? So good point to bring out. Polyglot language. Which is good because, what they have found is in archaeology, there are a lot of inscriptions that are in Aramaic and some other language. So Aramaic wound up being a really nice key to be able to interpret a lot of ancient languages because they had multiple transcriptions of those. I don't think it's one of the ones on the Rosetta Stone. I'll have to go back and look. But everybody's heard of the Rosetta Stone. There's four languages on that wound up being the key. They knew one of them, and they were able to put the others together. Nice big rock. It's really cool. Yeah.
From your studies?
You know, a lot of people, it takes a while to convince. The way I would interpret it, especially at this point, is Nebuchadnezzar was a very open-minded person who was a polytheist. And it was just fine for him to accept another god. He hadn't gotten to the point where he understood that Jehovah God was the only God. Does that make sense? And so I think you have to kind of look at him that way. And it's kind of like, you know, when Paul went to Mars Hill, they were perfectly willing to talk about another God, but not to eliminate all their others in favor of Jehovah God. So the quest for Nebuchadnezzar over his life is going to be whether or not enough things happen in his life and he sees enough evidence that he finally understands that there really is only one supreme God. Now, he does give God a lot of attributes here when he says he's a God of gods and a Lord of kings. But you even get that impression there, God of gods. He's not saying the God. He's saying he's a great God among whatever gods are out there. He hasn't given up anything so far. Good question. Good point. Okay. Chapter 3 then. We only have just a couple of minutes, but let's take a look at the beginning of it. We'll set the stage. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and the width 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Now, this is a big thing. How big is a cubit? Anybody know? It's about this long. Okay, that's a cubit. It's about 18 inches, ballpark. It varied depending on who the king was, because it was whatever the king's length of his arm was. But let's call it 18 inches. So it's 60 cubits high. How big is that? 90 feet. This is a big statue, right? Right, 9 stories. Was it solid gold? No, probably not. It was probably either, you know, base of stone and wood or whatever else. And then what did they do? They gold plated it. Okay, they wanted it to shine and be fancy and all that kind of stuff. But gold was still pretty rare. He's not doing 90-foot tall statue of solid gold. He sets it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Why would the king build this and set it up? What's the point? Partly emperor worship? Show of power? Yeah. You remember what the dream was? And he was the head of gold? I think he might have gotten a little bit of a big head over that and said, you know what, folks? I'm just going to make me one of them statues. And I know it was made out of different materials, but you know what? If I make the whole thing out of gold and I was the head of gold, what's that kind of say? That's my statement about my kingdom's going to last forever. And he set the statue up. Only the king has the resources to do this kind of nonsense. Okay, so it's a show of power. It's a show of wealth. It's a show of ego. You think this thing could be seen for a while? He didn't go hide it someplace. Instead, he set it up in a plane. Why would you set it up in a plane? You want people to see it from a long ways away, right? It's one of those things. I get this picture, and I know it's not quite the same, but my wife and I at one point took a weekend. We were going to go out and see the sequoias out of Sequoia National Forest. Anybody else been out and seen some of the sequoia trees and whatnot? Okay, you know, always read about how huge these trees were, and so I'm looking forward to really big trees. And as we're driving around in front of this corner, we started seeing some pretty good trees. Now, they were cedars, you know, and they're giants. But I'm looking at it going, okay, it's a big tree, but, you know, what's all the fuss about? You know, it just didn't impress me. And then we came around this other corner, and I went up, and I looked, oh, my goodness, that's a tree. You didn't really realize how big this thing was until you start getting at the base of it. And you stand at the base of, like, the General Grant tree where you could cut that thing off and build a house on the stump. That's a tree. Well, that's kind of the impression people are going to get of this statue, right? You see it off in the plane and you're going up and going, oh, somebody set up something out there. Wait a minute, we're still traveling. We're getting closer and it's not getting any bigger, you know, and finally it's just huge. It's just ego. So he's built this statue and notice what he says about it. Nebuchadnezzar sent word to assemble the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers and the judges and the magistrates and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Now, who's all this that he's calling? All the government officials. He's got everybody who's anybody. He gets an invite to the dedication of this statue. Now, folks, they're going to have grandstands set up. They're going to have big platforms set up. They're going to have the bands to play. This is a big deal, right? And he's going to show everybody just how great a king he is with this giant statue. And the satraps and the prefects and the governors and the counselors and the treasurers and the magistrates and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O people, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment that you hear the sound of the horn and the flute and the lyre and the trigon and the psaltery and the bagpipe and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of a blazing fire. And therefore at that time when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn and the flute and all those other instruments, they fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." Now, I don't know if he had special composers and they went out and had a theme, you know, and so it's like, when you hear this piece of music, then everybody falls down. I don't think they were just, you know, kind of randomly playing all their instruments and stuff, making some cacophony. That's not the point. He's got all of these things together, and, you know, he's gotten his best composer, and he's come up with, this is the king's theme, you know. And when they play this music, what's everybody supposed to do? Oh, yeah, we honor the king. You know, we're going to face the statue, whichever direction it is, and bow down. What's wrong with that? Okay, they're worshiping a statue. That's not so good. This is the same guy that just had this dream revealed to him and this other statue and things. Clearly, he hasn't quite gotten the message that God's in control of things, right? What's he setting himself up as? I'm the God. You all look to me, right? I'm the guy.